This is 91.3 KUAF. You can find out more about us at KUAF.com. And you can also follow along with us throughout the day through our Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram feeds. And this is Ozarks at Large for Wednesday, January 10th, 2018. I'm Kyle Kellums. Later on the program, the Salvation Army of Northwest Arkansas is a bit short after holiday collections were counted, and Ozarks at Large's Antoinette Grajeda has that story. Plus, Governor Asa Hutchinson is revealing his 2018 budget proposal and much more. That's ahead. First, for this Wednesday, the Arkansas Justice Collective, a local nonprofit, is hosting a six-week skills-building course on healthy relationships. The seminar is open to everyone, as well as to LGBTQ and immigrant couples in Northwest Arkansas who may not have access to such resources. Ozarks at Large's Jacqueline Froelich met with one of the co-facilitators to bring us this story.
Attorney Stephen Koger is director of the Arkansas Justice Collective, a nonprofit law group based in Washington County. The center practices immigration law and justice advocacy. AJC last year also began to host a relationship skills course for diverse residents. Stephen Koger with social worker Patrick Yang co-facilitate the class. Yang works for Ozark Guidance, a community mental health center based in Springdale. Koger, who is gay, says he first took the course while living in Seattle, and it changed his life.
I'm much more clear about my expectations and my needs, saying what I don't like, what I do like, and asking, not being afraid to ask, or being afraid but still doing it anyway.
The classes are held at the Elder Tree Center based in East Fayetteville.
6 weeks, once a week. We meet for 2 hours. We're going to, in the first class, explore our values, where they come from, things like really important things, like eye contact. Do you like eye contact? Like, where did you learn to like eye contact or not like it? And then that values discussion informs the next 5 weeks when we talk about setting boundaries, having conflict, stating our expectations with our friends or intimate partners.
The course reveals how Western culture is much like an iceberg. Above the water are things like food, dress, and language. Below the surface are unspoken realms of birth, relationships, and death. Koger says relationship skills are not culturally taught, but instead are acquired through experience, which is why courses like this one are critical.
You've got no skill set. And, you know, the facilitator when I took the class was saying that in our house, when we had a conflict, what I learned was that you scream while walking away and then slam a door. And then you act like everything was fine always. And I remember in my house growing up, we had a similar sort of conflict practice. And I would wonder as like a 3 and 4 year old, like, should I still be upset? Are they still upset? Because we didn't talk about it. We didn't try to address the root cause or the patterns that were creating these responses. And this class gives us an opportunity to pause and reflect. And it's really useful.
The course involves full group and working subgroups on subjects including expectations, boundaries, conflicts, even community connections. The course's foundation, Koger says, is built on anti-oppression and values, which comprised the first week of study.
And this class is super helpful specifically for when people are in relationship with people from different socioeconomic strata, from different backgrounds as far as immigration status. And having relationships across these differences and how we can navigate such conversations and such differences in a respectful way.
Week two is how to negotiate a relationship.
So we're really dismantling the myth that if you love me, you should know what I want. We're talking about actually stating our expectations, right? Stating our needs. And then once those needs and expectations are stated, negotiating, coming to some common ground about how we can meet one another's needs.
Week three examines true accountability in partnerships. Week four is articulating boundaries. The next course is on conflict.
This conflict piece is super important, and we have really fun exercises that we use to employ new ideas around conflict and new practices around conflict.
Koger says each topic requires role-playing. For example, to illustrate relationship expectations, referred to as accountability in the course, So what happens when a girlfriend cancels a date last minute to the dismay of her partner?
And we talk about how both of those are evading accountability. And then we, in the third role play, the flaking partner says, "This is what happened in my work day, and I apologize. We can come up with some systems to, like, make sure this doesn't happen again. How are you feeling now? Do you still want to keep seeing me? And do you want to give me a chance to do better?"
Couples are encouraged to come, Koger says, but with certain reservations.
They're not allowed to do any in-class workshopping together. They have to be in separate groups. It's great for couples because then they have a shared language about setting positive boundaries, which is, "I love it when you text me back within 2 hours," or negative boundaries, which is, you know, "Please don't text me 10 times in a single day," or whatever you need. Things like that. They have a common language about things like stating expectations or whatever. But in the last time we taught this course, there were no couples, and that was great too.
Confidentiality is prerequisite, Koger says.
In our initial class, we have maybe 15 minutes to just set certain agreed upon ground rules that often include not taking up too much space, but investing enough that you're willing to participate consistently. And one of those things that Patrick, as the social worker, makes sure gets said is that what is said here stays here.
Koger and Yang say the course is not therapeutic, not for processing specific experiences or relationships, but rather about building a functioning relationship skill set based on active listening.
Another common concern is that things will be discussed that could be triggering for people who have survived certain traumatic experiences. We make it very clear, and sometimes we have to repeat it, that this class is not for people to process previous experience, but rather to learn about new tools and practice those tools on the spot.
The cost of this 6 weeks course, which is held Tuesday evenings from 6 p.m. to 8 p.m., starting in early February, suits the lowest income participant.
So we ask people to pay $20 for the full 6 weeks. If they can't pay, we give them, of course, a scholarship, and they don't have to pay anything.
The semi-annual course is capped at 8 and open to all, but LGBTQ people are especially encouraged to apply.
There was a great article that came out this year on the epidemic of gay loneliness. And it talks about how a lot of LGBT people have internalized our prejudice, internalized prejudice from greater society, and how that infects, poisons our sense of worth and our ability to make a deep connection. So this class, we hope to remind people of their value and of their ability to set boundaries around their values and hopefully build better selves to then have better couples or better relationships of all types.
Applicants are initially screened by professional therapist Patrick Yang to determine if the course will suit their needs. If an individual appears to be in crisis, Koger says, they're provided appropriate psychological resources.
And it's not that we want to exclude anyone, but we want to make sure this is a beneficial experience for everyone.
Koger says the seminar teaches that relationships are negotiated based on intentions and choices. The class even examines the end of relationships, which should not be considered a failure, but rather a continuing resolution. For Ozarks at Large, I'm Jacqueline Froelich.
Deadline to register for Arkansas Justice Collective Relationship Skills Building Course is noon Monday. You can find links to this and other stories you hear on Ozarks at Large on our website, OzarksAtLarge.com. Don't forget, you can also subscribe to Ozarks at Large as a podcast through free services like iTunes and Stitcher. During its Red Kettle fundraising campaign, the Salvation Army of Northwest Arkansas had a goal of raising $420,000. However, once the donations had been counted, Salvation Army fell about $59,000 short of that goal. Ozarks at Large's Antoinette Grajeda has more on what this means for the nonprofit.
Your first conclusion about the cause of the shortfall might be that fewer and fewer people carry cash, which could be problematic for a fundraiser that relies on spare change being dropped into a red kettle. Northwest Arkansas Area Commander Joshua Robinette has been analyzing the numbers, and he has a different take.
We fell short not because people weren't giving. We actually fell short because we only covered about half of our locations. We had a difficult time, and I think it's part of the economy's really good up here, so we had a difficult time hiring bell ringers, which we have to do from time to time, and then filling the others with the other hours with volunteers.
Bell ringers are posted at about 70 locations throughout the region from roughly 10 a.m. to 7 p.m. every day during the campaign. Robinette says it takes nearly 23,000 hours to keep every station manned. This year, they were only able to staff locations for about 10,000 hours. To address the shortfall, Robinette says they'll have to make adjustments and plan on identifying alternative sources like foundations or corporations. In some communities, he says the Salvation Army will bring the kettles back out in the summer for a Christmas in July drive. He doesn't think they'll have to do that here in Northwest Arkansas. Another possible source of funding is developing more ways to donate electronically.
Tulsa this last year tested these things called dip jars, and it's basically a little machine that's attached to the kettle, and you just dip your credit card in and go, and it's a set predetermined amount, so maybe $3-$5 donation. And so we're going to kind of see what their results were. They were kind of testing it, piloting it for us, and you may see those next year around Northwest Arkansas.
While he's not yet sure exactly what course of action they'll take in 2018, Robinette says he's not worried.
I think that, again, the alternative funding sources we're looking at pursuing, I'm fairly certain we'll go ahead and be able to obtain. And so we're going to continue serving the same population of folks that we've served for hundreds of years. So, I'm not too concerned about having to make any drastic cuts to program or anything.
More information about the nonprofit organization is available at salvationarmyaok.org/NWArkansas. For Ozarks at Large, I'm Antoinette Grajeda.
Just ahead on today's show, Puerto Rico continues to recover after autumn hurricanes. One Newton County deputy was just there, working in an official manner.
A phrase I heard over and over and over from the people in there was the new normal. This is the new normal.
His account of a still recovering part of the United States in about 2.5 minutes on Ozarks at Large. Arkansas Governor Asa Hutchinson is proposing the 2018 state budget, a budget of about $5.6 billion. The governor says this budget reflects real cuts in spending and slower growth in Medicaid spending. Arkansas Public Media's Sarah Weitz-Kotacek reports on the plan's financial cuts and boosts and the governor's longer-term vision for reducing taxes.
Hutchinson says there is a projected surplus of $64 million in the new state budget, partly because of higher-than-expected revenues. He says he's using the majority of the extra money to create a reserve fund that only the legislature can tap into.
The goal is to create a surplus that will be a cushion for future economic changes, and they will come someday. But it will also be the foundation and sets the stage for future tax cuts and increasing the competitiveness of Arkansas tax rates.
The governor's plan would reduce some spending in education while increasing funds for county jails, foster care caseworkers, prison and public safety, and prison reentry. He also has asked Arkansas universities to freeze their tuition rates. And the plan proposes $142 million in increased spending on Medicaid. Hutchinson emphasized that the program is costing a lot less than expected. That's because it's smaller than last year by about 116,000 people who were taken off the rolls, he says, because many started working.
More people are working and increasing their income. So again, this is not a severe tactic. It is simply good news as the result of a growing economy and improved transformation efforts within DHS.
Whether to reapprove the state's health plan for low-income people, called Arkansas Works, is expected to be the biggest sticking point this session. Since 2015, the governor has successfully passed $150 million in tax cuts for lower- and middle-income people. He has said future cuts would benefit higher earners. Sarah Weitz-Kotacek, Arkansas Public Media.
Arkansas Public Media is a journalism collaborative, including Arkansas's public radio stations, and is funded by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. You can find out more at their Facebook page.
Walton Arts Center presents the Broadway musical Cabaret, running January 19th through the 21st. Sally Bowles and the disorderly Kit Kat Club Ensemble tantalize a nightly audience in Berlin as the pre-World War II environment grows more uncertain. WaltonArtsCenter.org or 443-5600 for tickets. Additional support comes from Highlands Oncology Group, helping patients fight the battle every day with a team of cancer specialists in both Benton and Washington counties. Services include radiation, CLIA-certified labs, a multidisciplinary lung clinic, and a lung cancer screening program. HighlandsOncologyGroup.com. Additional support provided by Entertainment Fort Smith, a monthly magazine with a comprehensive calendar of events covering live performances, dining, home design, lifestyles, and people profiles. Available at over 200 locations and on the web at efortsmith.com.
When a natural disaster strikes, law enforcement officers from all over the country respond in various capacities. That's how Newton County Sheriff's Office Deputy Glenn Wheeler ended up in Puerto Rico for 2.5 weeks right before Christmas. While on the island, Wheeler worked for a company that provides security to dialysis clinics owned by a company called Fresenius. Ozarks at Large's Susanna Sitek spoke with Wheeler about what it was like nearly 3 months after Hurricane Maria devastated parts of Puerto Rico. She began by asking him about the type of work he and other officers were doing there.
There's several different levels of who does this, and I work with, and all of our people work with a company, actually, that contracts with a medical corporation to go down and basically provide security is the initial reason we go. But this one was different in a lot of ways. This one turned more into, we did a lot of humanitarian stuff and a lot of aid. You know, most of the island is devastated, but the people down there are just amazing. And so we get to go initially when after the hurricane first happened, the first law enforcement that went in was purely security. But once things started to kind of get secured, then we saw a need, that the company I work with saw a need to not only provide that security for those clinics, but to help the people that are associated with those clinics. So the patients and the employees. And in furtherance of that, then we started seeing needs in the community. And I say we, I mean the company that hired us. And they have resources, and so they began providing aid and food to the people just in the community.
Okay.
And so it's both a security thing, and it's also a humanitarian aid thing. We do these both in the U.S. I mean, obviously, Puerto Rico is a U.S. territory, but in the continental U.S. and in territories. And initially, it can be pretty interesting when we first get there. For instance, Baton Rouge. We went to Baton Rouge after the floods, and we go fully armed.
So can you just tell me how sort of protection works with these services? Because I think sometimes people hear that, and unless you really have been in an area that, you know, where there's chaos and people taking advantage of that chaos. Mm-hmm. I think sometimes people hear armed guards, you know, at a clinic, and it seems like maybe a little bit of overkill.
Sure. I'll give you a few examples. One notable example is, and it made some national news, after Hurricane Harvey in Houston, some of the responders in the boats that were going out saving people were getting shot and shot at by gang members who were then stealing their boats. So while most people go into survival mode, there are a few predators out there that go into thriving mode because now all of a sudden they're in a situation where everybody's at a disadvantage and they can take advantage of that. So our job basically is armed security initially, which, again, I want to emphasize that that's our initial response. But with this company, it so often turns into so much more that is the part that is, you know, we show up armed for a very specific reason to take care of these people that we got to take care of. But it's the part that comes next that's so special. But the reason we have to show up like that is because there are those people that will take advantage of that situation and become very violent in doing so. Puerto Rico, for instance, at first there was a couple of the nurses that worked for this company that were robbed, and a couple of them were shot and killed initially.
So this was right after the hurricane hit.
Right after it happened and after things had just started to kind of start to regain some normalcy, because Puerto Rico is a very interesting place. It's a beautiful place, very much an island of contrast. You know, there's well-to-do and there's extreme poverty, and there's a lot of gang activity, and really violent gang activity. So the gangs had figured out early on, hey, these people leaving the airport in these rental cars are carrying cash, because initially there was no credit card machines, no power, so everything right. All the transactions were with cash. So they figured out early on that these people coming in to help had to carry cash. So they were carjacking and robbing folks that had just arrived at the airport and were right. going to work. That happened to a couple of these nurses. So we start providing the security to prevent that from happening. So our jobs ranged from everything from literally physically staying and sleeping at the clinics to secure that, to providing transportation for the nurses that are coming in from the U.S. and other places to relieve the nurses that are there. And so so part of the jobs is to basically be armed escorts for the nurses to get them to and from the clinics. And if they need to go to the grocery store, we take them under armed guard to the grocery store. I mean, it's a very interesting concept.
So when you first got there, what was your impression? Were you expecting it to be better? Were you expecting it to be worse?
Actually,
did it sort of meet your expectations?
I was expecting it to be a little bit worse than when I got there. I arrived later in this disaster. You know, some of the earlier other ones I've been in, I arrive earlier after it's over. But in this one, it was, you know, 2.5 months after the hurricane. So things had kind of returned to some normalcy. That island, though, there's going to be many parts of the island that don't have power for another year. So I said earlier, it's very much a place of contrast, because some places still have everything and some places they right. literally lost everything. I mean, there's, you know, the homes are gone. The people are living in tents on the beach and you know, it's just third world country-ish in many places. And then in other places, it's life is normal.
Were you in San Juan or?
I was in San Juan initially, which wasn't an experience in and of itself. I will say the people of Puerto Rico are some of the most resilient, beautiful, kindest people I've ever met until they get in their car, and then that all changes. So driving in San Juan was its own adventure. It was there are no rules or mere suggestions, and it was that was my job the first few days, was as a driver for the nurses in San Juan. I later got moved to Ponce, which is on the south side of the island, and I got moved down there to take over a clinic where they were having some issues with a manager. And so San Juan, and for the most part, the more touristy areas were in pretty good shape. Mm-hmm. They had power. Some of the shops were opening back up to business. There were a few cruise ships coming in. So they were, you know, trying to kind of get that rebooted. But you would go a block and it would be total devastation. You would see places where there would be literally a block with Lamborghinis and Maseratis sitting on it. And a block away, it would be, you know, like something you would see in a commercial on TV trying to solicit money for children in third world countries. It literally a block away.
What about that south portion of the island? Was that
south
different?
Portion of the island? The part I was in was also is kind of the same. Ponce was would have electricity. In fact, one joke I heard several times from the locals down there is the island of Puerto Rico at night is like a Christmas tree. It blinks off and on because the power would come and go. So they would restore power for a little while to a section of town, and they might have power for a day, and then it would go off again. And they might have it for a week, and it would go off again. A lot of the people at the clinic I was at I was staying in Ponce, but I was working in a town called Jauco, which is about 20 minutes away. And a lot of the people in Jauco were counting the days they had been without power, and when I left, they were at 92. And many of them were joking about it. The people are wonderful. They're resilient, faithful, just a beautiful. Many of them had lost everything they owned, literally. And every day they would come to us and offer us food and coffee. They're very proud of their coffee. They grow their own coffee, and it's really good. And you know, they would all bring coffee they had made for us, and they wanted to make sure we were taken care of. And we were supposedly there to take care of them, you know.
So, from speaking to people, what are they kind of saying that they need most, or what are they sort of wishing would happen?
Well, power is a big one. And the infrastructure down there was just so bad to begin with. And I will say, I've seen a lot of news and heard a lot of news about the feds not getting aid down there. And that's not exactly the truth. Part of the situation is stuff is getting there, and then it gets bogged down in the local government. The local government's fairly corrupt. there's a lot of aid sitting there waiting to go out, and it's either not being distributed or it's being distributed where it shouldn't be distributed. In other words, it's going to it's being redirected, so people are lining their pockets. But there actually is aid coming into the country. FEMA was on the ground hard down there. There's a lot of them down there. So it's happening, but it's a very interesting place. Just to give you an example, let's say Fayetteville, Arkansas, if we had the power out, we would call in power crews from all over the area, and pretty soon they'd all work together and get it back up, and it just doesn't work that way down there. It gets so tied up in local red tape that it takes days and days and days to start a project. It's just, it's a different culture. The people are very, very much not like that, but the powers that be are. Many of the people you talk to down there that live there and just have to live there, or not have to live there, they want to live there, but that they would prefer statehood.
Was your overall impression from people that they do feel like they will get back to where they were at least before the hurricane? Or are they sort of resigned to the fact that it will either, A, take a really long time, or B, may just not be possible?
Yes, A and B, both. They're not sure it's possible. If it is possible, it'll be a long time. A phrase I heard over and over and over from the people in there was the new normal. This is the new normal. And they just kind of expect. So one thing that's going on is you have one of the power plants was devastated. So they're trying to get power from one side of the island to the other. And to do that, you have to cross a fairly rugged mountain region that has been absolutely devastated. But even once you get into these towns, the infrastructure is just so, so poor. It's just going to take a very, very long time to even get close to back to where they were.
So when you started kind of offering some of this humanitarian aid as opposed to just security, what kind of things were you guys doing?
We were helping distribute some of the FEMA stuff that got out. Also, Fresenius, the company that owns the dialysis clinics, they started providing stuff. They all along provide food, water, shelter, generators, gasoline, whatever they need for their employees and their patients on some level. To their employees, they would provide a generator to each household and gasoline to run it, and gasoline for their vehicles. And they provided food for the employees and for the patients, and water. They bought washing machines and dryers and put them in the clinics that were, most of them were running on a generator, the clinics were. If a clinic didn't have a generator, they would buy a large generator and put it there. So the employees could come to the clinic and do their laundry and shower and stuff that, you know, you and I would take for granted every day, that's just not possible there. As they started to see the need within the community, they expanded that into also providing just for the people of the community. So if we had, 10 pallets of food to give out to the employees and 8 of them were used by the employees, we had 2 left, we started taking those into the towns and up in the mountains into the villages. And at some point along the way, some of our people actually started driving through areas that we had not been to see what the needs were, and we just carried stuff with them and would hand those out to locals. And there's so many wonderful stories of just people that had just resigned themselves, that they were just, they were just out of luck. And then all of a sudden these people showed up with food and they were just, it was an amazing experience to be a part of that.
So obviously you worked with some people in the medical profession. Mm-hmm. And there's been some talk about whether the death toll is really what the administration in Puerto Rico says it is.
Right.
Did you hear any stories from people that work there that said it might be more than that?
I did not.
I'm not sure if you got into conversations like that.
No, we did not. But I will say that during these expeditions, if you will, and it was expeditions because you had to sometimes four-wheel drive and basically saw your way into these villages 2 months later. You'd start door-to-door handing out water, and they'd say, there's no one there. They've all died. So, there was a lot of death from it. I don't know the numbers. I don't know how they compare to what the official numbers are. After seeing how things work there, I would say probably there's some discrepancy. But I don't know that. I would just
right, just from what you've seen,
based on what I saw down there, yes.
So is there any particular kind of moment during your visit, it's hard to call it a visit or a trip. It's more than that, obviously. But was there a moment that kind of stood out to you that you'll remember for a long time at all?
Let me tell you something. I saw it several times, but the first time I saw it was pretty special. Was at the clinic, the UPS truck backed up to the door, and he opened the door, and the truck's just packed full. And it's almost all Amazon stuff. which at first kind of took me aback. You know, I'm thinking that's kind of weird, but come to find out, most everything in the truck was for this particular clinic. And as I talked to the lady, the social worker at that clinic, who was kind of my main contact and just a wonderful person, and she explains to me that the company had given every employee in Puerto Rico, it was either $2,000 or $3,000 of Amazon credit to get what they needed for their home. And of course, this is 2 weeks before Christmas, so they're starting to load those Amazon boxes, and the nurses from the clinic are coming in, and they're clapping and dancing and crying, I mean weeping. And I'm thinking, oh, they must have got their kids Christmas presents, you know, or something. They're so excited. And when they start opening their boxes, and it was bed sheets and soap and shoes for their children, it kind of put things in perspective that they have lost so much that they're weeping over the fact they can now put sheets on their bed or have soap or shoes for their children. And so I saw that several different days as these shipments come in. But the first time it came in, it was very humbling, for one thing. This opens up, and it's these necessities that we take for granted every day, and they're weeping over them. And this is 3 months after, 2 to 3 months after the hurricane, and they're still in that situation. So that left a pretty lasting impression on me.
Well, thank you so much for stopping
by. Always enjoy it.
That was Newton County Deputy Glenn Wheeler speaking with Ozarks at Large's Zuzana Sitek. Wheeler says he is one of more than 200 Arkansas law enforcement officers who've gone to provide security services in Puerto Rico through the company that employs him.
Join us for the next Planet Money as we launch our very own satellite into space.
And on How I Built This, we meet Tony Shea, the guy who built the online shoe giant Zappos.
I'm actually not passionate about shoes at all. I'm passionate about customer service and company culture, so I can talk forever about those two things.
It's an hour of economics and innovation on Planet Money.
And How I Built This from NPR.
Planet Money and How I Built This, an entire hour about how economics affect us, Sunday night at 7 on 91.3. Earlier on the show, we heard about Governor Hutchinson's proposed budget for 2018 that includes a request for public universities to freeze tuition rates. Universities are reacting to the governor's in-state proposal. Education officials declined to be interviewed by our content partner KUAR in Little Rock, but did respond with written statements. Dr. Chuck Welch, president of Arkansas State University's system, says he respects, understands, and shares the governor's concern, but that it will take creative thinking to meet their students' needs. University of Central Arkansas President Houston Davis also wrote he respects and understands the governor's concerns and that they are consistently evaluating all funding sources available. And a spokesman for the University of Arkansas system said shortly after the governor's letter was released that officials are gauging what impact the tuition freeze would have on its school. The Wingate Foundation is giving the University of Arkansas more than $1 million over 5 years in support of the Arkansas A-Plus Schools program. That program, based in North Little Rock, but administered through the College of Education and Health Professions at the U of A, provides professional development and research data to member schools to integrate art education into those schools. The Siloam Springs-based Wingate Foundation's gift will provide more than $260,000 a year for 5 years for the program. Another new mountain bike-themed attraction is in the region's future. The Jones Trust this morning announced the construction of a 2.75-acre mountain bike skills park on the Jones Center campus in downtown Springdale. The course, called The Runway, will have three skill development lines, a pump track, and a children's playground and pavilion. The project is being funded by a $1.1 million grant from the Walton Family Foundation. A visitation and celebration of the life of a well-known Arkansas business leader will be tomorrow in Central Arkansas. Albert Yarnell of Searcy died this weekend. He was the son of Ray Yarnell, founder of the ice cream company bearing the family name, and worked for and ran the company for decades. He was 94. The Arkansas Razorback men's basketball team is home tonight after dropping back-to-back contests on the road last week. Arkansas faces LSU in Bud Walton Arena tonight at 8. Plenty of area college basketball teams are in action tomorrow. The Arkansas women will try to snap their own two-game slide at Georgia tomorrow night. Both John Brown University teams are also away from home tomorrow night, playing at Texas Wesleyan, while the University of Arkansas Fort Smith teams travel to Austin, Texas tomorrow night for games against St. Edward's University. And the University of the Ozarks basketball teams will be at home in Clarksville tomorrow night, hosting Belhaven. And finally, University of Arkansas diver Brooke Schultz continues to add honors to her brief collegiate resume. Yesterday, the freshman from Fayetteville was named the SEC Diver for the Week for the fifth time this season. Already this year, she's set the record for best score in program history on the 3-meter three separate times. The Arkansas swimming and diving team will be at home Saturday to meet Tennessee. That meet begins at 10 Saturday morning. This is Ozarks at Large for a Wednesday in January 2018. I'm Kyle Kellums. I'm inside the Harold and Blanche Cox News Studio with Timothy Dennis. Timothy, Happy New Year.
Happy New Year, Kyle.
Let's talk about what we can hear and see this weekend.
All right. Starting tomorrow night, if you go to Cork and Keg in Fayetteville, just across from the Walton Arts Center, roughly.
Right across the trail from the Dady Bombstead Studios.
Right. Voxana will be at Cork and Keg.
Choir, sing a static with the whole. We must memorize nine numbers and deny we have a soul. And in this endless race for property and privilege to be won, we must run, we must run, we must run. We must hang up in the belfry where the bats and moonlight land and stare into a crystal.
It's Stephen Pruitt. He does indie folk. He's from Fayetteville. That show is from 8 to 11 p.m.
Is that free?
I believe so.
Okay.
Friday night, Backspace will have a show. Model Zero will be in town. They're a hard rock band from Memphis. They'll be joined by locals Ten High and The Worms, which The Worms just released a new 7-inch record. They'll take donations at the door for the touring band. Show is scheduled to start at 9 p.m. Also Friday night, Route 358 will be at Black Apple Crossing in Springdale.
Yes.
That show is from 8 to 10 p.m. Again, Black Apple Crossing on Emma Avenue. Saturday night, Stage 18 will have Sad Daddy, one of my favorite bands.
Oh, I don't care anymore if you don't want me back. In fact, maybe I don't want you back. Maybe I don't want you back anymore. After you've been passed around all over town. No, I don't care anymore. You broke the 5-second rule. You love your crew.
They're old school minstrel folk. They're a 4-piece. That show has a $10 cover. It's from 8 to 10 p.m. And if you can't see them Saturday night, Friday night they'll be at Chelsea's in Eureka Springs at 9 o'clock.
And then I know next weekend, I think they're in Conway and Little Rock.
Right.
So maybe if our listeners toured the Russellville area way, think toward next weekend.
If you have time, definitely check them out because they're really, really, really fun.
Yeah.
Also at Chelsea's in Eureka Springs on Saturday night will be Red Oak Roots. That show's at 9 p.m. with a $5 cover. Then also Saturday night, Ruth's Chris Steakhouse in Rogers will have the Roby Pantol Jazz Duo.
Ah, difference between a duo and a trio.
There is.
Yes.
Difference of one.
Yes.
It seems to be a weekly affair throughout at least the month of January. That begins at 6 p.m.
All right.
And then in Fort Smith Saturday night, the Fraternal Order of the Eagles will have the Rusty Grove Band. Hmm. They're a red dirt country band from Tulsa. She works all week from 9 to 5. Then she gets in her car for that rush hour drive. But when she gets home, her day's not through. Cause there's a house to clean. That show will be in the Eagles Ballroom. It's from 8 p.m. to midnight.
My father used to be a bartender at the FOE, the Eagles Club, in Midway, Arkansas.
Really?
It has nothing to do with anything here, but I hadn't heard someone talk about the Eagles Club in decades.
Honestly, until I was preparing for this segment, I didn't know there was a Fraternal Order of the Eagles.
Well, there is.
All right. Now we're informed.
Yes.
Okay, now moving forward to Tuesday night, there's going to be something really cool, or I think is really cool, at Arcadia Retrograde here in Fayetteville.
Oh, over there in Evelyn Hills?
In Evelyn Hills.
Okay.
So the Bit Brigade, they're a five-piece band that does covers of classic video game music, but with a twist. Not only do they cover the songs, but they cover them as the soundtrack to a live playthrough of the game in question. And these are typically old NES games, Nintendo games.
So, in other words, the game is going on, and they're playing the theme.
Uh-huh.
Who's playing the game? All right. But this is going to happen at the arcade.
Yeah, and the game that they're doing on this tour will be the NES classic, The Legend of Zelda. Which anyone who's played NES knows that that game is extremely hard when you have all the time in the world to play it.
Okay.
But if you're playing it live in front of an audience, I can't imagine kind of the stress that would go into that.
I'm asking you for answers you may not have, but so is then a member of the ensemble is playing the game.
That's the way I understand
it.
And
then the band is watching the game being played.
And they're
then
playing the live accompaniment to it.
Okay. And so could the live accompaniment change depending on how the game goes?
Theoretically, yes.
Okay.
That's what I would assume.
Okay. That sounds wildly fun.
Yeah, it does, doesn't it?
What is this again?
That's Tuesday night at Arcadia Retrocade in Evelyn Hills here in Fayetteville. That's from 9 p.m. to midnight.
Wow.
Yeah.
Okay.
And then also Tuesday night, there's another show I'd like to spend a little bit more time to talk about. First of all, let me just tell you a little bit about Carrie and Debbie Moore. Carrie and Debbie Moore, they've run Moore Outfitters in Dover since the late 70s. They also organized the annual Creek Fest on Memorial Day weekend on Big Piney Creek. But last year, Debbie was diagnosed with ovarian cancer, stage 3. And then later in the year, Carrie fell ill with some other illness that left him unable to walk, at least for a while. They were able to keep their business open, but there wasn't a Creek Fest last year. But Tuesday night, a group of people connected to the area music scene will put on a benefit concert for them at George's Majestic Lounge. The Little Buffalo River Band, the One Ounce Jig, and Jamie Lou and the Hullabaloo will perform. There will be door prizes, other stuff going on as well. Kim Smoots from shindigmusic.net, she's one of the organizers of the show. And last month, she and Jamie Lou Connolly joined me to talk about the show inside the Furman Garner Performance Studio. Smoots told me that she's known the Moores for years and that they're really an integral part of the Big Piney Creek floating community.
I mean, they're just really awesome people. They've helped all of us out, even if it was something as simple as, here's your life jacket, make sure you put it on. You know, hey, there's a tree down on the second bend. Go to the left or you're going to eat it, you know.
Which is valuable advice if you're just fooling.
Or I locked my keys in my truck. What am I supposed to do? And, you know, they're like, we'll help you figure it out. They're just really nice people. I can't count the times I've went up there and they didn't even charge me. When I was young and broke and just a kid, they're like, it's okay. We'll put you on anyways.
Really, they're kind of like family in the floating
community.
They really
are. See, they came up with Creek Mom Strong is the hashtag that they've had for the last year. And she really is everybody's Creek Mom. And he's really everybody's Creek Dad. They're just all around awesome people. They'd give you the shirt off their back if they could, you know, if you needed it. They've always tried to help in the community. They've, and like I said, it's just the little things they do. It's not even, you know, they've done countless big things between, you know, saving people's lives, rescuing their boats, their stuff, whatever, you know. I've seen Carrie Moore stand in the middle of a rapid in a raft with a chainsaw to cut a tree that everyone had been hitting, and some people got hurt on it. And so he was, I say a raft, it might have been a canoe, actually. But, you know, he's up there just, like, whole in this middle of this rapid just with a chainsaw, like the most dangerous thing in the world, but he did it because so many people were getting hurt and he didn't want to see them getting hurt. He's just, they're just that kind of people.
So how did the idea of this benefit show come together?
Well, I've worked for them in the past, and I helped them with Creek Fest, and then I also worked at More Outdoors, you know, helping them rent boats and stuff on the weekends. And I just had seen that, you know, it just seems to compound. It's like they get over one hurdle and here comes another. And then they get over that one and here comes two more. And I just really wanted to help them. And so I got together with Travis Smith with Emerge Entertainment. I got with Robert Locke with Shindig. And I was like, I don't know how we're going to do this, where we're going to do it, who's going to play it, but we're going to do it. And so it's just all come together within the last 3 weeks.
That's incredible.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, George's was awesome. They gave us the venue for the night and worked out a good deal with us on that so we could have it somewhere that's easily recognizable, a lot of people are familiar with. And we decided to do it in Fayetteville because there's a large amount of the paddling community and the musician community that live in Fayetteville that know them, as well as, you know, they've had a benefit in Pope County and Dover for them. And those people are there helping them on a regular basis. They're cutting trees down that were about to fall in their house, fixing a hole in their roof, you know, just these little things. And they're already helping out so much. And there's a huge amount of transplants from that area. And so we decided to just go ahead and do it here in Fayetteville. And the support from the Fayetteville community has been amazing.
So Jamie Lou, you have agreed to play this benefit. Why did you decide to get involved?
Well, Creek Fest was one of my first shows that I ever played. And Nash Moore, son of Debbie Moore and Carrie Moore, was in the music scene at the time and kind of took me in and helped me play. And so I kind of found, you know, a home there as far as like, okay, this is a safe space and I can express my art here, and people are friendly and they're supportive of things. And so any way that I can help.
And you played multiple times, didn't you?
Yeah.
I think as far back as 2013, if mm-hmm. I remember, or 12 even.
I think I didn't play like 1 or 2 years, but I don't remember why, but I came back, last year or the year before that. But that's why I'm involved, and I love those people. And like Kim said, I mean, it's just hurdle after hurdle, and anything that we can do to help, you know, I want to be a part of.
So what is the ultimate goal of this benefit show?
It's to raise as much money as we can to help them offset their medical costs and just their travel costs with the different treatments and, you know, to be able to cover things if they do, you know, need some more repairs on their house, they can, you know, get it taken care of. Because they went for a while with that hole in their roof, you know, just because they couldn't deal with it. And so it's just things like that to help them out with all the expense because it's becoming a huge expense. And the thing is, Debbie spoke with me. She's not going to be able to come. Chemo and crowds don't mix. So we're working on getting a videographer that can record the show so she can watch it because all three bands are her favorite bands. But One Ounce Jig, she always has had a special place in her heart for them.
That was Ozarks at Large's Timothy Dennis speaking with Jamie Lou Connolly of Jamie Lou and the Hullabaloo and Kim Smoots of ShindigMusic.net. The Moore benefit is Tuesday night at George's Majestic Lounge in Fayetteville. Doors are at 7. Music starts around 8. Tickets are $7 online in advance and $10 at the door. door prizes from various area businesses, musicians, luthiers, photographers, and more will be given away. You can find out more about the show by searching Facebook for More Outdoors Benefit. And on Friday's edition of Ozarks at Large, we'll hear more from Jamie Lou when guitarist Garrett Rowland joins her inside the Furman Garner Performance Studio. That's on Friday's Ozarks at Large at noon and 7 on 91.3.
Ozarks at Large is underwritten in part by the Walton Family Charitable Support Foundation. Additional support provided by the Northwest Arkansas Business Journal. The current edition features the 2018 Northwest Arkansas polling issue, including the largest mortgage lenders, plus local business news from Northwest Arkansas. Subscriptions and information at 725-0394 or nwabusinessjournal.com.
And before we complete this edition of Ozarks at Large, let's mention a couple of additions that have taken place in the last 24 hours. Reed Carroll was newly elected to the Siloam Springs City Council yesterday in a special election. And there is a brand new manager of the Northwest Arkansas Naturals who will start their next season in April. Vance Wilson, who had been manager at the Naturals, has been promoted to be the bullpen coach of the big league parent club, the Kansas City Royals. He'll be replaced by Mike Rojas, a Miami native. And yes, Mike Rojas is the son of Kansas City Royals legendary second baseman Cookie Rojas. He'll be the new manager for the Naturals this season. A service of the J. William Fulbright College of Arts and Sciences at the University of Arkansas. This is 91.3 KUAF, Fayetteville, Fort Smith, Bentonville, and Springdale. Speaking of Springdale, Friday night at Black Apple Crossing in downtown Springdale, the band Route 358 will be performing. You can learn more about them at route358.info. They've been to the Furman Garner Performance Studio a couple of times. This is from one of those sessions. The song is Let It Burn. Ozarks at Large is a production of KUAF. I'm Kyle Kellums. Thanks so much for listening. Enjoy this slightly warmer Wednesday. We'll be back tomorrow at noon and 7 with a brand new edition of Ozarks at Large. And as always, you can listen to past shows and individual stories at ozarksatlarge.com. I locked the door and watched it burn. I'm on the run, not sure what from. What I've been through, there's not a guilty bone inside. Bruises heal, someday I'll feel some remorse, but I feel nothing now. Gasoline. Watch it burn. Pour the whiskey and tell it made him smile. Little flirting kept it flowing for a while. Let him down and I slowly slipped him burn. Lock the door and watch him burn. Lock the door and watch him.